Hello and welcome to the Martian Drive-In podcast number 58. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around we're doing a couple of interesting films. The first one is from 1980, and it's a horror film starring Michael Caine called The Island, based on a novel by Peter Benchley. The other one is a little bit older, it's from 1960, and it's an English horror film for which I have a lot of fondness, called Circus of Horrors, starring Anton Differing. So sit back, relax, grab a munchie, and we'll get on with the introduction and the podcast. Back soon. The Martian Drive-In podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of science fiction, horror, and fantasy movie appreciation. It doesn't matter what it is, it could be all the way from Georges Méliès through to Michael Bay, though I'm not likely to do Michael Bay. But feedback is important to me. So if you want to leave some feedback, you can leave it at cultguru, K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U, at gmail.com. You can leave it at the Martian Drive-In podcast website, marsdrivein.blogspot.com. The other thing you can do is go over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. So if you type in Paleo-Cinema Cafe into Facebook, you can go and leave some feedback there as well. Now, there are occasionally adult concepts in this podcast, so just keep that in mind as you listen, and sit back and enjoy the rest of the show. How you doing, people? Yes, so here we are with another Martian Drive-In podcast. We're looking at a couple of horror films this time, one of which is a horror in a couple of ways, which is the 1980 movie The Island, starring Michael Caine. And then we're looking at another one, which from 20 years earlier, which is a good, honest, old-fashioned, in-colour horror movie, Circus of Horrors, which I like a lot and I saw first in my youth, late at night, on a black-and-white television with rabbit-ear antennas. So going back to that. And it's a movie that I've got a certain fondness for. I think it's got some interesting people in it as well. And it tells an interesting story. So, there's been a lot going on in science fiction circles at the moment. I'm not going to bore you with it because I talked about it in Paleo Cinema last time around. But, things are getting really strange and weird. And I'm finding that the culture wars that I've become increasingly aware of over the past few years do seem to be heading in a much darker and nastier direction. Now, because of my various problems in the past, I can get triggered by this kind of thing. So I'm kind of trying to back off on it somewhat because it doesn't help me particularly. But when I get personal attacks online after asking some reasonable questions and making some observations, that can be a trigger for me. So I've got to kind of ease up now on that kind of thing. Nonetheless, In 1998, I had the honour of handing out a Hugo Award in Baltimore. And so I've got a psychological interest in the Hugo Awards process and awards in general, and the fairness and the equity that a good award ceremony and award process brings. So I'm going to not say anything more than that, apart from the fact that it has had a bit of an effect on me. But I'm moving on and I'm going to talk about movies for the rest of the podcast. Which is not true, because I'm not going to do what have I been watching lately. I'm going to do what I've been reading lately. And I've just completed, after a marathon effort, the Kim Stanley Robinson Mars trilogy from the 1990s. Three very thick books, though on a Kindle they do seem to be a lot thinner, about the colonization of Mars. There's Red Mars, there's Green Mars, and there's Blue Mars. And it's an epic story. It's had the best science it had at the time, though the science has drifted a little bit. There's a few things like the fact that there are high perchlorate levels on the Martian surface, which can affect thyroids in human beings and all sorts of shit like that. But it's a great story and a good hard science story, as well as a good human story. And it tells the story of the first 100 colonists on Mars, taking the story through a couple of hundred years after that colonization starts. And I highly recommend it. Now, I do have a story to tell which doesn't show me in a very good light regarding the Mars trilogy and Kim Stanley Robinson. Very fine genre author. Highly recommend all his stuff, and he's a very nice person. 1995, I was at the National Science Fiction Convention, Thylacon, in Tasmania, and one of the guests was Kim Stanley Robinson. And I was lucky enough to be given a Dipmar Award as Best Fan Writer that year. And people clapped for me. There was a lot of applause when I went up and got the award. I'd been nominated something like 12 times. I hadn't got one. So there was a lot of applause when I went up there and came back. I was really blown away by winning the award. And ended up in the bar at night at Hadley's Hotel in Hobart, Tasmania, with a whole bunch of people, including Stan and a few other people. Some guy called Gaiman was there, I believe. And we were all having a drink, and people were shouting me drinks because I'd won and things like that. And though it doesn't happen very, very often, I was a bit drunk. So I'm sitting next to Stan, and I leaned over and said to him, "It took you 3 novels to terraform Mars. It took Arnold Schwarzenegger 3 minutes to do it in Total Recall. What's your problem?" And he looked at me, and I looked at him, and then he said, "You're right, you know." So that was my story. I was a total dick, and Kim Stanley Robinson was very, very gracious to me at the time. So I have always had a great fondness for the man based on that. Plus, I like his work as well. But, yeah, I do recommend the Mars Trilogy. Get a copy of it. It's out for Kindle. It's out in Dead Tree Edition, and it's a really good read. And revisiting it, I'd forgotten all the details, because with 3 very thick novels, you're not going to remember all the details after 20 years. But it holds up incredibly well, and it's good, solid science at the time. And definitely check it out. But we're going to talk about horror movies this time around. Horror movies are a kind of secondary love for me after science fiction movies and old movies. But there are still horror movies that I like. But I thought I'd look at one that I don't particularly like, and I think it's a bit of a dog's breakfast. But I'm going to talk about that after the break. So I'm going to take a break now, and then when I get back, we're going to talk about the 1990 horror pirate movie, The Island, starring Michael Caine.
The Caribbean. A vacationer's paradise. And yet this region was once a stronghold for outcasts, thieves, and murderers. A savage race that vanished hundreds of years ago. But what if there were survivors? And what if they kept their existence a secret from the outside world? What if someone found out? The island, where civilization as we know it has taken a bizarre turn.
Who are you? I mean, all of you. Are you some kind of religious cult?
If I'd wanted to hit you, I could have hit you. You're not my father.
Stop this make-believe.
Fire! Pirates?
I know it sounds crazy, but you better believe me.
All those who have discovered the island have never been seen again. The Island. The super thriller from the author of Jaws and The Deep.
Find the Maynard man. Cut his throat. Ah!
Mayday! Mayday! You guys wouldn't believe what the hell.
Now, the most terrifying thing in the water is the island.
That was a very, very 1980s trailer for The Island, a movie directed by Michael Ritchie, and had stars Michael Caine, David Warner, Angela Punch McGregor, Don Henderson, Dudley Sutton, Colin Jevons, and Zakes McKay. Now, here's the story, and you've got to get a bit of backstory about Hollywood at the time to understand this fully. 1975, the first ever summer blockbuster movie came out, Jaws. Spielberg had so much trouble making it. It became a smash hit anyway. It was fantastic. Went over the top. It was big. That movie happened to be based on a novel written by Peter Benchley. And it varied from the novel a lot in many, many ways. But ultimately, Peter Benchley became hot property. So in 1977, there was a movie called The Deep, which starred Jacqueline Bisset and Nick Nolte and Lou Gossett Jr., which did kind of okay business. I really like the soundtrack album of it. I think that works really well. It's got some great music in it by John Barry. But it wasn't as successful in any way at all as Jaws. So 3 years later comes another movie based on a novel by Peter Benchley. In this case, The Island, starring our friend Michael Caine. Now, Michael Caine's career was in a bit of a slump at the time. He was taking jobs basically because he'd had some dodgy financial advice and didn't have a shit ton of money at the time. He was still doing okay by any normal human terms, but he'd worked for 20-odd years and still he needed to kind of keep working. So he took this job on. This wasn't the hit that he needed. And there are a number of things wrong with the movie. First off, the premise is pretty ropey. And what's the word? Silly. Here's the story in a nutshell. People in boats are going missing in a certain part of the Caribbean. Bermuda Triangle, blah, blah, blah. A New York journalist, played by Michael Caine, takes his son on what he thinks is just going to be a little bit of a fact-finding trip in the area to see what's going on with these missing people and ships and why the local country, this tiny little tin pot country, isn't doing anything about it. So Michael Caine, his son, and a very dodgy pilot end up crash landing on the airstrip of an island because the pilot is too stupid to put down the landing gear. And so they pancake, ship blows up, Michael Caine and his son end up on this island and find a cottage to rent and go and hire a boat and head out to see what's going on, because this is the way you do investigative journalism. So they kind of wander out into the open ocean. There are all these islands dotted around there. It's off not very well charted area, not populated at all. So they go off in a small boat and see a canoe, and what seems to be an empty canoe floating past them. Now, we know this isn't good news because there's a scene at the start of the film where a whole bunch of people are killed by pirates. Very gory scene. One guy gets his guts ripped open by an axe. So it's, full on, full tilt boogie. So Michael Caine and his son basically end up getting captured by the descendants of 17th century pirates who are living in this little mangrove encrusted island in the Caribbean, haven't had any real contact with civilization at all, still live the old ways. They're getting inbred, they're fucking crazy and totally feral, and they make their living by basically pirating. They get their little sailboats and take them, rob and kill people, grab all the stuff, take it back to the island, because that's what they've always done. So these people have had no real contact with civilization except for one particular subplot. And so they're taken aboard. Because the Michael Caine character's surname is Maynard, that's the name of a famous pirate who's mentioned in the great big book that these raggle-taggle descendants of pirates have. He gets treated like royalty, and they decide that he's got to impregnate the wife of the man he killed when they were capturing him, played in this case by Australian actress Angela Punch McGregor. Now, when we first see her, she's covered in mud and looks pretty ragged, but you can tell underneath the mud that she's not bad looking. So that's one thing. Michael Caine's got to knock up this woman. When she's pregnant, he's going to be killed, because you only ever have to knock up one woman to save a tribe from inbreeding and extinction, of course. Silly subplot number one. Second one is that the king of the island, played by David Warner, playing it pretty much stone-faced David Warner style, decides that he's going to adopt Maynard's son and raise him as his own, because he's already got a kid, but the kid's Portuguese and he's not white, so he can't be a proper son. And so he decides to brainwash and keep Maynard's son. Mostly they do the brainwashing by sleep deprivation, propping his eyelids open with toothpicks and talking at him all the time and getting him totally bewildered and basically mind-fucking the poor little kid. Meanwhile, Michael Caine sleeps with Angela Punch McGregor while tied up, because, of course, you know, it's not my fault if I'm tied up, and then makes various attempts to escape, one of which ends up with him being stung by Portuguese man-of-war jellyfish, which is very painful. Meanwhile, he sees a whole bunch of very gory and nasty stuff, including a couple of pirate raids, one on a sailing boat, which is smuggling cocaine, and he decides, I've got to get the fuck out of here. Now, you've got to remember, Hollywood spent $22 million making this film, and it was supposed to be a great big... It was going to make them a fortune. It was going to be a big film, but it's set up to fail for a number of reasons. First off, stupid M. Night Shyamalan-level plotline. Really stupid plotline. Just because it was a book by Peter Benchley, they thought that they had lightning in a bottle and that he had a golden touch, that anything based on one of his novels would do really well. Didn't turn out to be the case. This one ended up with Michael Caine getting a Razzie nomination for Worst Actor. And the reason for that is pretty simple. Michael Caine does not bring his A-game to this movie in any way at all. He's stone-faced and you know, he just goes through the motions of this. I don't know whether he was unhappy at the time or whether he's going through a midlife crisis or whether he had hemorrhoids or what. But Michael Caine does not bring at all his great technique and prowess to this film. You got to remember, this is like 9 years after Get Carter, where he showed that he could be a fucking good actor. And it's before a whole bunch of other things he did, like Educating Rita, where he showed he could be a good actor. This is middle period Michael Caine, when he was just doing it for the bucks. And his character is crazily underwritten, and Michael Caine's just basically phoning it in his check cashing in this case. Not one of his best roles at all. The other problem is the pirates. The pirates are all played by English character actors, and that requires them to kind of be wearing not too much clothing at all and crazy necklaces and hair pieces and all sorts of other weird shit. And none of them are plausible in the least, and there's a very singular reason why. And to play convincingly, a tribe of people descended from 17th century pirates living a rough life in a mangrove swamp kind of area, doing incredible amounts of seamanship, hunting, gathering, plying things together, doing all that kind of stuff. These guys have the muscle tone of English stage actors. Nobody in a primitive tribe of any kind is as skinny with as little muscle tone as these guys are. David Warner has his shirt off and he's kind of skinny, but not in a kind of wiry way the way that some tribes are. He's just skinny, you know, I've got to watch my diet because I'm playing Hamlet next week kind of way. And a bunch of the other actors are the same. It's got Dudley Sutton, a good character actor, and he kind of does what he can with the role. Colin Jevons, another good character actor who does what he can with the role. But as primitive tribesmen, even if they are descended from Englishmen, they don't really put it across at all well because of that simple anatomical anomaly that's there. These guys are supposed to be vicious, nasty, feral pirates who jump on board ships and club and kill people regularly. And apart from a few of the locals who were in as extras and who did have a little bit of muscle tone, all of the main pirates are weedy little fuckers. Really problematic from the point of view. It doesn't add any plausibility at all. It's a bit like they were doing Pirates of Penzance, drop some acid, and they're playing, and they're at some kind of weird fucking tropical rave party half the time. Doesn't work at all. The other problem with the thing is that the kid playing Michael Caine's son, and it's not the kid's fault, kids are kids, but the guy playing his son is a kid called Jeffrey Frank. He's playing his son, Michael Caine's character's son, Justin. He had two film roles before he decided he would be better off doing something else. One in Germany playing a Hitler Youth in 1982, and this one, The Island, in 1980. He fell off the radar after that, but he's not particularly gifted as an actor, really. So basically, this film is a dog's breakfast. Now, Michael Ritchie, the director, did some interesting work, but not in this film. He did a whole bunch of episodic TV early in his career in the 1960s, including a TV series I like a lot called Run for Your Life, which starred Ben Gazzara. He did The Outsider, another TV series starring Darren McGavin. He directed some episodes of that. He did Semi Tough, The Candidate with Robert Redford. Semi Tough, Divine Madness, the documentary with Bette Midler in it. Fletch, which was a successful movie, The Couch Trip. A very ropey film with Eddie Murphy called The Golden Child. He did the Fletch sequel. Fletch Lives as well. And then he did Cops and Robinsons with Chevy Chase, Fantastics, and ended up, he died at the age of 62 in 2001. So he kind of had a career where he had a couple of movies that did pretty okay, but this is not one of them. I don't think that this genre was really his métier. I think that it's a very pedestrian job of directing, really, and particularly if you're kind of going for that blockbuster and you tried to emulate something that somebody like Spielberg did, then you've really got to get somebody young and hungry and new and not just a jobbing director to direct something like this if you want it to really work. And the absurd premise of it really does drag things down a lot. Now, I got this movie for $6 from Umbrella on Blu-ray, so I thought I'd give it a go. And as I started watching it and I saw the scenes in New York with Michael Caine playing a journalist and playing it pretty much like any role with Michael Caine wearing a suit, not with that kind of cynicism and the edge that I know journalists have, people who've seen it all and really have a breadth of knowledge. I mean, journalists are interesting people. If you've ever met any journalists, they are interesting people around, and they've got all the stories and they're fantastic raconteurs and they know secrets they're not allowed to tell. But none of this plays at all in the Michael Caine stuff. Really a poor job by him. Yeah, well, fair enough, he wants to make a living, but we have to watch it. Well, we don't have to watch it, but we end up watching it. So basically, there's a couple of interesting things in the movie. A couple of the character actors do some interesting stuff. But in general, the action scenes are rushed and a bit confused. And the ending, the climax at the end of the film, is a Deus Ex Machina ending. The Machina, in this case, being a 50 caliber machine gun mounted on the deck of a Coast Guard cutter. And it's absurd. And there's a scene after that where the head of the Pirates, whose name is Now, played by David Warner, stalks Maynard through the bowels of the cutter, which has been disabled by the fact that the Pirates have killed all of the people on board it. And there's a kind of, you know, stalking in the darkness. There are occasionally red emergency lights there. There's a lot of smoke in the place. And there's absolutely no tension to the action in this. You know what the ending is going to be, and the direction and the setups are incredibly pedestrian in this film. It really doesn't give you full value for even the $6 I paid to get the Blu-ray. I'm going to keep it because I'm going to inflict it on some people and say, here, you want to see a really bad Michael Caine movie, borrow this. And you would have thought that after an experience like this, Michael Caine would have learned his lesson, but he didn't. He went on to star in Jaws 3, based on a Peter Benchley novel, and again he cashed a check in that one as well. Now, I've got a lot of respect for Michael Caine. I've covered movies of his in the podcast before, and I've got enormous respect for him as an actor, and this doesn't diminish that at all, but it does show that even people who have great late careers, I mean, Michael Caine still gets accolades for what he does in his movies. He's really even in his 80s playing his A game when he likes the material. But again, it shows that even people of that caliber can, when times are bad and when, you know, things aren't particularly going their way, end up putting out substandard product. Now, I don't like the fact that he did. I think that he's a much finer actor than that, but times are different now. The movie careers of actors are different now. And I think that he may have got his head straight after this bunch of really shocking films that he did at the time. Though in the same year as he did this, he also did a movie where he was kind of more interesting, though not nearly as interesting as he has been in other things. It's the same year as Dressed to Kill came out, the Brian De Palma horror movie where he played the psychiatrist of Angie Dickinson's character in the film. Now, that, again, was a kind of interesting role. I don't think it's particularly a fantastic Michael Caine role, but at least he had a little more to sink his teeth into than this film. But there's not too much else to say about The Island, except for the fact that you probably, if you go to see it, and some of you may well do, and I'm not trying to dissuade you at all from doing that, but if you do, what I'd suggest is a couple of beers, a couple of friends, really front-load it by telling them that it's going to be a bad Michael Caine movie, and then sit down and watch it with that sense of irony and detachment that will enable you to enjoy it at some level. But if you're going in there going, oh, geez, this is from the same guy that did Jaws, and, oh, wow, I've got to see this movie, it's got Michael Caine in it. No. If you want to see that movie, I'll give you two more recommendations of Michael Caine movies from before the 1980s that I recommend and that I haven't covered on the podcast. Even though it's not a particularly great film, you can always go with Deadfall from 1968, where he plays a cat burglar and who gets involved with a very weird couple played by Eric Portman and Giovanna Rulli. It's got a great John Barry soundtrack to it, and it's for kind of style over substance. Directed by Brian Forbes, based on a Desmond Corey novel. It's more interesting than The Island. The other one, of course, is a war adventure, directed by Andre de Toth, who also did House of Wax. And it's got a kick-ass cast. Apart from Michael Caine, you've got Nigel Davenport, Nigel Green, Harry Andrews, and a bunch of other people. But basically, this is a North African war movie called Play Dirty from 1969, which I recommend. It's got a lot of guts, it's a bit of fun, and it's a shit ton better than The Island was. But I'm going to leave it there. I just thought I'd mention the film because I bought a copy of it. I thought I'd give it a go. I wanted to do a horror double feature for the podcast, so I decided to give it a fair go, and it disappointed me poorly. But I think as a kind of bad movie to watch in company, it could be okay. But if you're watching by yourself for pleasure, go with some other Michael Caine movies rather than this one. But anyway, I'm going to take a break now. I want to get back and talk about a really good, gritty, little, lowish budget English horror movie set in a circus called Circus of Horrors from 1960, which stars Anton Differing and Donald Pleasence.
If you are a murderer, a blackmailer or a thief, with a face as ugly as sin, and a mind as distorted as the devil's, then this man, he might help you.
You could be beautiful, if you would trust me.
Think twice before you join his circus of horrors. He'll change your face beyond recognition, but your soul, he'll enslave for all time. Remember, he alone will know the secrets of your evil past, and never will he let you escape alive. Anton Differing as Dr. Schuller, who rose to glory in a trail of blood. Erika Remberg as one of the girls whose face and fate he changed, but not her mind.
You can't frighten me. These others, they've been stupid, just plain stupid.
What others?
The late unlamented ones who have died so suddenly and so strangely.
This is the little girl with a maimed face who was forever beholden to him.
I am beautiful.
Who grew from innocent childhood into trusting adolescence.
I would do nothing to hurt you. I owe you so much. I love you so much.
She was his one weakness. This maniac who first healed and then killed.
Rosita.
What just happened was an accident.
Every second is filled with unexpected danger and terror. As a doctor, a specialist in horror, uses his sinister skill to make a circus of criminals perform at his bidding.
Okay, so that's the trailer for Circus of Horrors from 1960. A nice little horror flick, which I saw first when I was very, very young, which means that it's responsible for how fucked up I really am as a human being. The movie was written by George Baxt, a very interesting writer who went on in the 1960s and 1970s to write a gay police procedural series of novels with a hero called Pharaoh Love, who was a big black gay copper. I've actually got a couple of the George Baxt novels, and they are kind of groovy stuff. Not quite as politically correct and sensitive as they might be had they been written today, but he was quite an interesting writer. The movie was directed by Sidney Hayes, who later went on to do a lot of episodes of the TV series The Avengers, the one with Patrick McNee and Honor Blackman and Diana Rigg and all of those people. So he did a little bit of that. So this movie has a pretty good provenance. It was put out by Anglo Amalgamator, which is always one of my favourite names for an English movie production company. Anglo Amalgamator sounds just so 20th century, really, the 1900s. It's one of those names that really sticks there. The cast is pretty good, too. We've got Anton Differing as Dr. Schuller, a.k.a. Dr. Rossiter. Erica Remberg as Alyssa. Yvonne Malauer as Nicole. Donald Pleasance turns up as Vanay, the original owner of the circus. Conrad Phillips playing a copper. Conrad Phillips was the guy who was in the TV series of William Tell back in the 1950s, and a few other people like William Mervyn and Yvonne Romain and Walter Gotell we see in the film and recognise. Now, I'm going to give you the plot straight up from IMDb because it's a fairly short one and it shouldn't be too bad there. In 1940s England, Dr. Rossiter, Anton Differing, is a plastic surgeon wanted by the police after an operation goes hideously wrong. However, believing himself to have brilliant abilities as a surgeon, he and his assistants, played by Kenneth Griffith and Jane Hilton, evade capture and escape to the continent. There, Rossiter changes his name to Schuller and befriends a circus owner, Donald Pleasance, on whose deformed daughter, Nicole, he operates. This is the person who becomes the Yvonne Monlow character. Schuller manipulates his way into running the circus, taking it over when the owner dies in a freak accident. He was attacked by a bear. A decade later, he is running an internationally successful circus, which he uses as a front for his surgical exploits. He befriends deformed women and transforms them for his temple of beauty. However, when they threaten to leave, they meet with mysterious accidents, which raise the suspicions of local police, who are soon on his trail. And that's pretty much the plot of the film. It starts out with Rossiter and his gang escaping, and you get to see the woman whose operation went wrong, who later comes in towards the end of the film and helps resolve the plot line. And, it's right up there with those kind of, deformity horror movies of the time. Things like The Hypnotic Eye, and a few other ones where, women are deformed, are either made deformed or fixed from being deformed by plastic surgeons. And plastic surgeons were an interesting concept. And you can remember, this is 1960. This is 55 years ago. In 1960, it's only 15 years since the end of World War II, so there were a lot of people with disfigurements and deformities due to the war. There was a group at one stage, I don't know whether they're still around, but there was a group at one stage called the Brotherhood of Smash Mugs, who were a bunch of soldiers of various kinds who suffered facial deformities during the various wars, and who formed a kind of very loose international support group for it. So there's all this kind of stuff going on at the time, which makes it really interesting. And indeed, an Australian Prime Minister was one of the people who was deformed by it. John Gorton, who was a Prime Minister before Gough Whitlam, it might have been Billy McMahon after that, but around that time anyway, early 1970s, indeed suffered some facial deformities during World War II and nonetheless became a very successful politician in Australia. And it wasn't a pretty-looking face, but the surgeons did a fairly good job of reconstruction. And he went on to have a fairly successful political career. So all of this stuff was part of the zeitgeist at the time. It's less so now, where a lot of plastic surgery does miraculously good things for people. And fortunately, there are fewer of them, except in certain countries where jilted male lovers and husbands have a tendency to throw acid at women. And that kind of makes this movie have that frisson of darkness about it still. When you kind of compare it to what's going on in real life in the 21st century, which it shouldn't, of course. But Anton Differing's in this one. I like Anton Differing a lot as an actor. He's interesting from a couple of viewpoints. He's a little bit like Konrad Veidt in a way. He was a German character actor. He was born in Koblenz, and his father was a Jewish shop owner. So he and his mother was a Christian. So he fled Germany in 1936 to escape persecution, mostly because he was gay. And a number of these number of actors were kind of fleeing the persecution for homosexuality, and some other family member was Jewish or they were Jewish. That's all part of that diaspora of talent that happened at the time, where people fled westward to either the UK or America in order to avoid the meat grinder that was the Nazi regime at the time. And Differing was one of those. He started out playing mostly, and this is the ironic part of a lot of those guys, playing Nazis. I mean, it's a bit like having somebody who survived the Holocaust in Cambodia playing Pol Pot. There was a lot of that around, a lot of them playing Nazis. And he went on to have a very good career right up until his death in 1988. So he did an episode of a serial of Doctor Who. He did another movie, another horror movie, which I should talk about in the podcast, called Man Who Could Cheat Death, which was really interesting. And he also starred in Fahrenheit 451, directed by, of course, Francois Truffaut, and I've done that in a previous podcast. So I like Differing. He's got very blue eyes and chiseled features and blonde hair, and he kind of looks the part of the perfect Aryan guy, even though he was a gay half-Jewish gentleman who held the Nazis in as low a regard as the rest of the world did. So we've got Anton Differing there playing the villain. Donald Pleasance in a fairly early role. I think he may have been wearing a rug in this one, where he plays a drunken French circus owner. And he's a very endearing character. It's a nice little character role by Pleasance in this one. It's a couple of years before he had that great role in The Great Escape as well. But in this one, he really does put it across really well. And in a sense, he does show the ambiguity of the Schuller-Rossiter character, where Schuller/Rossiter does make a difference to people's lives, particularly the young girls, when he fixes the deformity at the side of her face, the scarring that she got during the war. And so there's that side of the character as well. Plus, but then as things go on, he starts finding women who are prostitutes and thieves and murderers, and starts glamming them up for his Temple of Beauty as a part of the circus sideshow, as his circus becomes much bigger and bigger. And they end up, they're all bloody stunning women. And they all end up as a part of that. And he sleeps with a number of them. And the other thing he doesn't like, of course, is that when they want to leave and actually start a life and not be a part of a circus, he arranges for weird accidents to happen, because accidents do happen in circuses. They're not the safest of places to work. And that's where the kind of darkly comedic almost stuff comes on. And they've got this really creepy pop song that they play as a part of the circus. And I'll just play a chunk of that for you, and then tell you why I think it's a hilarious song in some sick and twisted way.
Seem worth the living, and you don't really care who you are. When you feel there is no one beside you, look for a star. When you know you're alone and so lonely, and your friends have traveled afar, there is someone waiting guide you. Look for a star.
See what I mean? It's a very kind of rinky-dink 1960s style pop song that would have been on a jukebox in a highway cafe in England. That kind of weird sounding about it. And all that depressed stuff at the start when life doesn't seem worth the living and all that kind of thing really adds to the darkness of the movie. And every time you hear that as a part of the... They're playing it in the background while the circus acts are going on. You know that the woman strapped to the board of the knife thrower is going to meet a horrible death. And you know the woman who isn't very good at it, but they get to do the lion taming, isn't going to end well. And you know the woman on the high wire isn't going to live for very long because they've all slept with Rosser and they've now rejected him and want to move on with their lives. And Rossiter, for reasons of the fact that he's played by Anton Differing and he's fucking insane, decides that he is going to kill them. And the circus starts getting a reputation as a jinx circus, and that things are going wrong, and the cops start taking an interest, of course, and one of the cops falls in love with one of the girls. It's all of that kind of stuff that you get in these kind of movies of this vintage. But it's a lot of fun, too. The gore effects are quite interesting in this film as well. They are quite dark, and surprisingly graphic for the time, which surprised me a little bit. They use that that kind of theatrical cinematic blood that they use at the time in England. You see it in a lot of Hammer horror films. It's actually called Kensington gore, and it's very vivid and very thick and doesn't look like real blood at all. But when you see it in a movie of this vintage, and this movie is in kind of eye-catching Technicolor, it does get the story, get the thing across that, yes, that woman with the knife sticking out of her neck wearing a very skimpy costume is definitely dead because she's got a lot of Kensington gore kind of splashed across her body. And, you know, it's a very misogynistic movie if you want to look at it from a modern viewpoint, but because it is so relatively low budget and because it does have those gore effects and because it is kind of outrageous in a Grand Guignol sort of way, it's kind of endearing in, as well. Maybe it's because I did see it when I was a kid. I saw it black and white on a late night horror TV show on a Saturday night. And it repeated for years. I think it was on Channel 10 in Sydney at the time. And every now, a couple of years, you'd get Circus of Horrors showing up there. And you'd get other things like The Hypnotic Eye, which again has women being disfigured in it. And yeah, I like this movie for that reason. I also like it because it does have some genuine circus action. It was filmed in Billy Smart's circus in England, which was a fairly successful and large circus. And of course, that cuts down on the amount of money you have to spend on sets if you've got a real circus happening there. And it was filmed on Hampstead Heath for the most part. But, yeah, you get clown acts and things like that. You get the knife-throwing guy is quite good. He's a kind of old English guy dressed up like a Native American, throwing knives and axes and that kind of thing. And he does a pretty good job of it. I always like a good knife-throwing act. If you want to spend some time playing around on YouTube, you can find lots and lots of tutorials on how to throw knives and some very interesting characters doing that. So I did a little bit of research on that, and then I kind of pulled back from it and went, no, I've got to get a podcast done. I can't spend all my time looking at knife-throwing videos on YouTube, which will then lead on to other things, and I'll have wasted all of my research time just watching somebody standing in a paddock throwing bits of metal at a tree. So I kind of avoided that one. But, yeah, it's one of those movies that's very much for an adult audience. On the Wikipedia page for the movie, there's an interesting thing. There's a film critic called David Peary who considered it to be the third entry in Anglo-amalgamated Sadian trilogy in a book called A Heritage of Horror, because the film focuses on sadism, cruelty, and violence with sexual undertones. So the previous films in the trilogy, which this film critic David Peary has suggested, were Horrors of the Black Museum and Peeping Tom, both from 1959. I've seen both of the movies. I mean, we all know Peeping Tom, the Michael Powell one, which kind of 86'd Michael Powell's career with a lot of people because it was just, you know, maybe 5 to 10 years ahead of its time as far as that kind of movie is concerned. But yeah, I kind of like this era of British horror films, and Horrors of the Black Museum, I've got to say it correctly, is interesting as well. It starred Michael Goff, and Shirley Ann Field was in it. I haven't seen it for a little while. It's had a budget of $164,000 and made over $1 million in the box office. But that one may be one to add to the list for the podcast as well. There's a kind of window there just after Hammer came in with their Frankenstein, The Mummy, and Dracula, where a whole bunch of studios were trying out vivid, colourful horror films. And some of them are well worth considering and well worth looking into. I really do have a fondness for that era of British horror films. They tell us a little bit about the society that produced them, which is always the interesting thing with horror films. Any horror film from any era you can name tells us something of the society it came from. If you have a look at 1930s Universal horror films, they're a lot about how America was at the time. You look at 1940s ones, they're a lot about where America was at the time. And in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, and into the second decade of the 21st century, there's always that sociological context for any real horror film, and they reflect the fears that society has and the events that are going on in the political and social realms of those particular societies. But just to get back to Circus of Horrors for a minute after I've gone on that little tangent, Circus of Horrors is kind of cool because the circus is a good setting for a horror film. Circuses are, in the sense, entertainments with a mystery wrapped around them. We know that what goes on the stage and all that kind of thing, but there are people who live lives very much unlike our lives who produce that entertainment for us. And they have really unusual skill sets. There are acrobats, there are trapeze artists, there are clowns, there are people who tame wild animals, though that, of course, is becoming less and less of something that we see in circuses as the animal rights people, and probably with some valid arguments, say that we should phase animals out of circuses. And, of course, that is something that people who carry shovels in circuses are quite in favour of as well. And in a weird way, the circus performers do have supernatural or almost supernatural powers. Throwing knives with accuracy, staying in a cage with wild carnivorous cats, playing, doing the physically adept stuff of a circus clown, hanging off a rope or a wire or a bar way up high and then throwing yourself from one to the other. These are really unusual skill sets, and it makes it a mysterious and wonderful place for us. I mean, one of the things I remember was I was just hitting puberty and I went to a circus, and the kind of sexy muscularity of a female circus artist was something that impressed me a lot at that stage. Probably still does to a certain extent, but just that kind of strength and health and vitality is a really interesting thing in circus performers. And of course, suddenly we have not only the mystery that is a circus and those weird skill sets that circuses have, but in this film we've also got a hidden agenda and other skills, the surgical skills of Dr. Rossiter / Dr. Shuler, for instance, and the fact that all of the circus performers are themselves criminals hiding with the circus as a cover, which gives you an extra layer there. It's not something that's particularly drawn out and particularly fleshed out as a part of the plot of the movie, but it's sitting in there as well. All of these women who are stunningly beautiful and who pose as Helen of Troy and Joan of Arc and all these other characters, maybe not Joan of Arc, but all of these classical characters in the Temple of Beauty in the circus are all people with hidden pasts and hidden agendas, and that kind of adds a little frisson to the movie itself. And it's a good, honest little flick. It did very well at the box office at the time, which is always a nice thing. It always seems really unfair to me when you've got a movie that's trying to do something, you can see what it's trying to do, and it's doing pretty okay with it, and it's showing you something that you don't normally see in this kind of film of this kind of era, and they do bad at the box office. It feels unjust in a weird way that we can see the qualities of these movies now, but at the time they were made, they couldn't be seen. So when movies aren't successful in the time they came out, but they are films of quality and films that are really interesting, that pisses me off for some reason. It's like you want to go back in a time machine and throttle film critics, which is probably, there's a story there for somebody. But anyway, just to round it up, Circus of Horrors, a lot of fun. The Island, not so much fun. The Island, apart from anything else, took itself way too seriously as a film. I really think that it didn't have the guts to kind of camp it up slightly in what it was doing. And because of that, Peter Benchley Association really did take itself too seriously. Now, I'm just going to end up with a couple of things. First one is I watched all of the new Daredevil TV series on Netflix over the last 24 hours, which means I spent about 12 of those 24 hours watching the damn thing. And to be honest with you, I kind of liked it. I think it worked really well. It gives us a very different angle on the Marvel universe that's being portrayed on this TV and the movie screens. It shows a more street level, a more gutter level view of the Marvel Universe. Charlie Cox is very good as Matt Murdock / Daredevil. The guy playing Foggy Nelson is good. And of course, you've got Vincent D'Onofrio playing the Kingpin, Wilson Fisk. And he has a terrific arc as a character. It's an incredibly well fleshed out character. Over the 13 episodes of the series, which of course, this being Netflix, they released all at once. They just uploaded the whole lot for us to watch. And Australia got to see it at the same time America did, which is nice. You get the time and you get the ability to have that arc of character and to understand why Wilson Fisk is who he is and why Matt Murdock is who he is and why some of the other characters are as well. It really does give a chance for some good writing and good acting to prevail. And because it's Netflix and because they do release every episode all at once, you don't have that need for a slight cliffhanger at the end of each episode. There's a continuity and a seamlessness. It's like watching a 12 or 13 hour movie in some ways, where it doesn't have those sharp transitions and the cliffhangers that you get at the end of something like an episode of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., where because it is on network television and they're kind of feeding a small spoonfuls of it in 44-minute lots, that it doesn't have that seamless feeling. But this one definitely does, and I really did enjoy it. I think the first three episodes set it up nicely, but the real guts of it get from about episode 6 onwards is where the real guts of the story happens. And it's it does tie into the rest of the Marvel Cinematic Universe very well. There are mentions and little bits and pieces. And there's one character in particular who has a mystery about her. Well, there are two characters with mysteries, but there's an older female character, that's all I'm going to say, who has a mystery about her as the first season ends, which makes you want to see more of the character. She's one of the most interesting characters in the movie. She's called Madame Gao, and she's a Chinese drug smuggler. And she's a really interesting character. In fact, there's not really a dull character in the thing. So I definitely recommend that you check that out. It's worth doing. And I got a free month of Netflix, so it didn't actually cost me anything to watch it, which is always nice. But I think I'm going to continue the Netflix. I've had a chat with Sal, and we decided that maybe we'd take off the Foxtel movie channels from our Foxtel cable subscription and replace them with a Netflix subscription and save ourselves a few bucks that way, but then get what Netflix has to offer. Now, our internet, one of the problems with Australia and Netflix was that a lot of people don't have a very good internet connection with the ADSL, but we're kind of fortunate in that way. We've got enough to be able to surf the web while we're watching Netflix and things, but people I know only a few kilometres away have a less stable connection. This was one of the reasons why we were going to have a national broadband network when Labor was in government, but it's now been kind of had the nuts cut off it by the more conservative coalition government we have at the moment, and that pisses off any number of people. But I'm going to end the episode there. One of the other things too is, if you hear this before the 17th of April, you've still got the opportunity to join the Patreon campaign and make a micro payment each month to the podcast if you're interested to, and your name goes into the box to win the box full of movie related stuff that I've got sitting right behind me, which I am going to give out every year on my birthday. So get in for that. And wherever you are on this clay and granite planet, I will send you the box if you win it. But anyway, that's about it. Keep watching the skies. Keep watching movies. Keep enjoying yourself. Be happy. Live your life large. Don't drink too much coffee like I did the other night. And I will see you very soon. And as usual, the credits for the podcast come up next, as in the style of credits from a movie. So take care, and I'll catch you later. And here are the podcast credits in the style of movie credits. So thank you to all of the Patreon campaign subscribers who are put a couple of bucks in and help out the podcast. First off, I'm going to go this at random. So first off, we have Tom the Focus Puller, Sarah the Special Effects Technician, Ian the Caterer, Grant the Technicolor Consultant, Claire the Script Doctor, Gary the Prop Master, Morris the Musical Director, Jan the Dialect Coach, Armin the Key Grip, Matt the Rattlesnake Wrangler, Elaine the Scientific Advisor, Julia the Casting Director, Chris the Camera Operator, Christopher the Gaffer, Miss Jane the Wardrobe Mistress, Tansy the Foley Artist, Alyssa the Location Scout, Mark the Second Unit Director, and Paul the Special Makeup Effects Director. So thank you very much to all of the supporters of the podcast. You help this out a lot and it really is appreciated. And of course, as usual, thank you to Mr. Claude Debussy for playing the music.